to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Intisar, and Umbreen will join us over Skype in a little bit. Intisar is on the faculty of Boston College Law School, where she teaches comparative Islamic law and legal history, advanced constitutional law, and criminal law. And Umbreen is co-founder of Islamics along with Intisar, and she's a staff attorney in the Civil Rights Litigation Program at the Disability Rights Legal Center in Los Angeles. And they're here to talk to us about their project, Islamics, which is very exciting. Welcome.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm glad to see that it's a full table. Welcome to the fall, by which I mean not that things are going down from here, but autumn.
So
we're really excited. And Urs neglected to mention that he's also a partner in the Islamics project, for which we're really grateful. And I'm glad to see that lots of folks from the Berkman Center and the Islamic Legal Studies Program and the other folks working on Islamics and other people are sort of gathering together, and we'd love to get your ideas about what you'd like to see the project to do. So we'll make a few remarks and then hope to engender discussion about, and really hear from you about your thoughts and what the project should be doing. So there are three points that we want to point out, and I'll take the first two, and Umbreen Butsi, who you can't see, will jump in on the third. And the first is just to situate what this project is, what Islamics is, given the uptick in media coverage on issues relating to Islam and Islamic law, which are often simplistic and sometimes even misleading stories on the issues. Yet this is an issue of increasing public importance. So we want to just trace what that increased coverage looks like and then talk a little bit about why this even matters. Why should we have a website devoted to addressing these issues or a service devoted to addressing these issues? And then how can we actually address the problem? And following all that, we hope to, or throughout all that, we'll lead you through the Islamic site and hopefully open up after that and get some of your input. So the stories about Islam in the digital media age are increasing, and they are simplistic, sometimes misleading. So as we surveyed the American news ecosystem, we've noticed this radical increase pretty much over the past decade. And we think there are at least a couple reasons for this, amongst others. One is there's a growing Muslim minority in America, and that is to say growing because Muslims have a long time presence here. Muslims came over, were brought over with slaves. Estimates of anywhere of up to 10% of all slaves brought over were Muslim. And there was a big wave of conversion of African Americans in between the 1930s and 1960s. And a big migration from Muslim-majority countries in the 1960s that really increased the Muslim population. And estimates now are somewhere between 8 and 15 million, split roughly equally between what we'll call, for lack of a better term, indigenous, so African-American, Latino, white Muslims, and immigrant groups who come from or are the children of Muslim-majority groups coming from Muslim-majority countries. And another reason why there might be this, and so you have this increased population in America. And so another reason why there might be an increase in these news stories, obviously, would relate to the events of 10 years ago with 9/11. So like it or not, there are foreign policy considerations that came along with the tragic events of 9/11. And there are domestic ones as well that we think that we think lead to bringing some of these issues a little bit closer to the fore. What does the increased presence of Muslims in America mean for politics, for judicial institutions, for relations more broadly amongst Americans. So the result is that now there's an urgent need to understand Islam around dinner tables, on Capitol Hill, in my classrooms. I teach Islamic law in faculty lounges. I'm always being asked about, well, what is this Islamic law? And elsewhere, more generally, in the public square, there's a growing curiosity. So all of a sudden, my subject of long-time research before the events of 9/11 have turned from this obscure, historic, academic subject to something that's become of more public relevance for ordinary citizens, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, and for academic and government institutions. So why does this matter? This can have serious consequences for the communities involved, meaning the general American community, in broad terms, and in narrower strokes, the Muslim community as well. And we only need to look at a couple of examples to demonstrate that point. One was the Park 51 debate, the so-called Ground Zero mosque that we heard about ad nauseum last year, or beginning last year in 2010. So then, just to give a little bit of background for those who might not have heard about that debate, when politicians and pundits unfamiliar with Islamic law called the mosque that was planned to be built about six blocks away from the site of Ground Zero and Al-Qaeda Victory Mosque, this stoked perhaps understandable fears about the propriety of locating a mosque so near to the site of national tragedy from 9/11. And beginning in July of last year, we had prominent figures like Newt Gingrich, several congressmen and others sort of amplify these claims of a Ground Zero mosque, of a victory mosque at Ground Zero. And then over the next 6 months to a year, experts of Islamic law in small drips and drabs weighed in to comment on this issue and explained a few things. One, that Islamic law unequivocally regards any terrorist attacks, and therefore the attacks of 9/11, as abhorrent acts contrary to Islamic law. Second, or two, they said there is no duty on Muslims to wage jihad, quote unquote, as the pundits claimed, and particularly not in America, which is not a Muslim country, does not exist under the rules of Islamic law, and not in the modern day, where there is no longer the setup that even if there were a duty to engage in warfare in a Muslim country in the medieval period, that structure doesn't apply today. And third, they said that mosques may only have a religious and charitable purpose, according to Islamic law, to serve local communities, which seemed to be consistent with what the organizers of the Park 51 event were saying, that they wanted it to be modeled on the JCC nearby. So the idea was not to signal victory of any un-Islamic attacks or anything of the kind. But the point isn't the intricacies of the arguments or the motivations for those who wanted to build the mosque or opposed the mosque being there. The point was that there was a narrative being put forward about what the relationship between Islamic law was and events happening that had very real effects on the community, on zoning laws, on politics. And the corollary to that point is that journalists and the media had a large role in reproducing these claims, and that ended up affecting in real ways the debate in the public space. So when journalists did consult the Islamic law experts, very gradually, they were able to identify or clarify what Islamic law, what it was and what it was not, in ways that then affected or dissipated, allowed the debate to dissipate. So the debates died down, but not before a lot of national controversy and perhaps local harms, and increased tension surrounding issues of religious liberty, accommodation, zoning laws, politics, and the like. And in fact, there's a Berkman-related note here in that
Ethan Zuckerman and his interest in understanding the connection between the media representations and how they spread and perhaps how they affect other public debates actually traced this issue in the tool that he developed called Media Cloud. And we can actually track on this Media Cloud how the debate spread from the legacy news media sources to the blogosphere and back again, and then how the gradual gradual trickle of information, of actual information, made its way into those spheres, and that we can draw connections between this and the debates dissipating. And just to very quickly point to a second, more current controversy that Islamic law in the media now has engendered is to point to the recent wave of anti-Sharia legislation, where we have over a dozen states, almost 20 states now, that have considered legislation to ban Islamic law from U.S. courts. And there's a lot to say about that, but I'll just briefly say that there's no evidence that judges across the country are in fact applying Islamic law in their courts or have a design, a nefarious design, to impose Islamic law in U.S. courts. And from an American law legal perspective, arguably, the bans proposed are unconstitutional, and what they attempt to do, moreover, is unnecessary. And in my view, this is actually an attack on courts that, again, is rooted in this issue of information about an issue of public import, Islamic law in this case, that has connections with and problems engendered in the dissemination of that information on media channels. So that's the fall, and hopefully Umbreen can describe somewhere up from here. So that's the problem. Is Umbreen here? And what you have here is the site, and I'll probably be cycling through the site a little bit as she speaks.
Okay. Can you all see me or hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, because all I'm seeing is a black screen with a spinning wheel. Indusar, thank you first for reminding me that it is fall, because we don't actually get that here in Los Angeles. So that is a nice thing to remember. But thank you, more importantly, for laying out what I think the problem is that Islamics is intended to at least try to take a stab at fixing. The real question then is, how do we actually address that problem, right? And the first thing that I think we do is we recognize that journalists who cover these stories about Islam and Muslims have a hard job, that they're operating in good faith, and that they're attempting to cover stories for which they have little to no resources. So the second thing I think we do then is connect them to the expert sources and resources that are going to help them do that job more effectively. And that, I think, happens through the project that we're calling Islamics. So what is Islamics? Islamics is an educational resource and an information service that is going to connect citizens, media producers, and legal scholars to authoritative information about Islamic law. Our goal for the project is to improve the quality of discussion about Islamic law that happens in the American news ecosystem. We do that by providing context and relevancy to existing news coverage and serving as a nonpartisan resource. So, Indusar at the beginning noted that there was an uptick in stories about Islam and Muslims in the news, and the reality is there is, in fact, that uptick. So why, then, are we focusing on Islamic law? And the reason is actually that when we looked at stories about Islamic law, stories about Islam and Muslims in the news, it turned out that a lot of those stories were, in fact, stories about competing interpretations of Islamic law. So what appeared at first glance to be a story about, say, culture or theology wasn't, in fact, such a story. It was a story about competing interpretations. And that, I think, probably relates to the fact that Islam is a law-centered religion. And Indusar, of course, as the expert, can talk a lot more about this. But in effect, religious practice for Muslims really takes the form of norms called law or Sharia, which you've heard lots about at this point. And law, therefore, ends up making a major part of a practicing Muslim's life. So I'm going to give you a couple of recent examples. First, the one that Intisar covered, the Ground Zero Mosque, or the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, or Park 51, or whatever you want to call it, that was just about a year ago. That debate ended up being about a lot of things, including legal. Do Muslims have the right to build there? If they have the right to build there, is it still appropriate for them to build there, and so on? But the really interesting story, I think, in the middle of all of that were the comments that Intisar referred to, this idea that mosques represent some sort of victory symbol, that mosques are the symbol of jihad, and that when Muslims successfully wage jihad, what they do is they plant a big, huge mosque with a minaret and really let you know that they've won. Now, is that in fact an accurate understanding of jihad under Islamic law, and is there a connection between mosques and jihad? So the second story that I want to raise is this story of the ongoing anti-Sharia bans that you're seeing pop up around the country. Now, in Oklahoma, for example, Oklahomans passed, I think, by 70%, some enormous number, a state constitutional amendment banning judges from considering what they called Sharia law in Oklahoma courts. Now, absent this amendment, could courts in Oklahoma be required to apply Islamic law? Now, the third story is just going to go back a little bit more, and that's, if you guys can remember, even before the Ground Zero Mosque story and so on, in the spring of 2010, there was the latest kind of uproar over cartoons in the Muslim world. This one was about Comedy Central's decision to air what ended up being a heavily edited episode of South Park and the subsequent then Everybody Draw Muhammad Day that ended up being launched on Facebook. Now, are depictions of Prophet Muhammad prohibited, and are they punishable by death under Islamic law? So the three questions I raised in each of those examples, the answer to each of those is no. Islamics didn't exist at the time that these stories were actually taking place, but we think that had it existed, it would have been nice for Islamic scholars and for our service to be able to provide the additional context and nuance that would have made those stories more interesting to all of us and would have clarified some of the noise that I think existed around all of that. So really, I think what's going on is that a lot of the controversies that are surrounding Islam in this present day and age are really fueled by ignorance of what Islamic law is. But in fact, there are experts who can explain it to us. And Intisar, her colleagues, really, I think there are about 16 of them who are experts in Islamic law and American law and who can talk with a lot of sophistication about what the interplay is between American law and Islamic law, you know, what religious accommodation laws are like, whether Islamic law has any role in the American legal system, and so on. I think about 13 of those so far have signed on to our project. And these experts now, you'll see them sort of throughout the news time and again, but what we're hoping through the project is to be able to streamline their participation and have you all hear a lot more from them. So Intisar, I believe, has been able to put up the site, and I hope that you guys will all get a chance to take a look at it and maybe send us some feedback. I'll make sure, I guess, that she shares our email addresses with you and send us any thoughts you have about whether we can do this differently or in a more effective way that we haven't thought of. That's it from my end. Thanks.
And so you see
the scholars associated with the site. The broader idea is that we want to aggregate news. We're working to build a trending tool that will perhaps give a visual depiction of recurring trends in news reporting on Islamic law, and then have a third component where we add context to all this content and trending data through presenting some of the having the scholars comment on some of these stories in accessible, non-overly specialist or academic ways. So any questions, comments, objections?
So I haven't looked at it, and I missed a couple of minutes, but I guess, you know, first of all, it sounds like exactly what the world needs, and, you know,
Good to hear. But
to be fair, you know, what else would all of those state legislatures have to do with their time if they didn't pass these important statutes that they're passing about Islamic law? But anyway, leaving that aside, my question is, how do you establish your credibility? How do you? I would assume that there are people in the Muslim community worldwide who fashion themselves as experts on Islamic law who say that you're just wrong. And, you know, you've repeatedly stated your values of being nonpartisan and authoritative. I think I heard you use both of those terms. But where authoritative, who is the authority? I mean, and this is obviously a general question of which, you know, we've heard many instances in discussions around this table, you know, over the years, in the absence of the legacy media to tell us where the authority is, why is your site more authoritative than some radical site?
Thank you. That's a really great question. And for the tech folks here, Umbreen has lost her connection. So if there's any way you can restore her, that would be great. But while she's being restored, So that's obviously a big question. How do you establish authority? You want to promote yourself as an authoritative site? Says who? So two elements of this. One is that you're indeed right on the money and that there's, sort of all this diversity of interpretation in Islamic law. There's no church as there is in Catholicism where you can get authoritative edicts either directly from a Pope-like figure or one of his representatives. There's no state that is, the state of Islamic law. There are all these countries, Muslim-majority countries, that purport to apply Islamic law, and then those are done in different ways. So in recognition of that, what we wanted to do is not to try to paper over the diversity of views, but to include as many folks as possible who could represent the diverse views within what I'm calling Islamic law as a broad catch-all term, but I'm actually referring to as a lot of different interpretations of some foundational texts that are within the Islamic context and that end up having different interpretations in different locales and in different points of history across time. So the scholars that we have associated with the site that I've placed up here are all people who have JDs and in American law and PhDs or the equivalent. And so they're recognized experts in their fields for both American law and Islamic law in the American context. So part of the answer is that our aspiration is not to be global in scope in the way that we're trying to convince the world of the varied interpretations that these scholars may point to, but we're trying to complicate the picture but also bring some clarity or a go-to place for members of the American news readership, journalists, and that sort of thing. So really to help inform and shape the conversations going on in the American context. So what's to say this is more authoritative than just doing some random Google search? I think part of the issue that we found is that there is no site that does this currently. Even if you do a random Google search, you'll, just sort of get a lot of results and not know how to navigate between them. At least with this site, the folks here are transparent. They may differ amongst each other, but they'll tell you the basis of their, their differences or their interpretations and seek to speak very directly to the ongoing trends.
That might be your answer, is that no one can fairly speak with authority about what Islamic law is any more than anyone can speak with authority about what Protestantism is, right? There's an entire range of religious belief contained within Protestantism.
And let me add to that a little bit.
Or Jewish law would be maybe.
Yeah, and let me add to that a little bit, but then I don't want to interrupt your question. I'd actually make the analogy to the Supreme Court as well. Who speaks for what American law is? And we have an institution for that. We have the Supreme Court, but then we have nine justices who have, you know, we have textualists and originalists and pragmatists and that sort of thing. So it's not to say that there are no rules to the game. But there are rules, and then there are different moves that you can make across the board if we analogize it to chess.
And if it's possible, I'd like to add just one more point. Can you all hear me? I don't know.
Yes.
Okay. So the question that you've asked about authority, I think, is the essential question, and it's a question that we have thought about for a very long time. And I think the way we think about it is that the experts on our site, their credentials are transparent, and therefore, the sources upon which they rely when they're making certain opinions available to people on our site are transparent as well. And if there are people whose opinions are differing and fit the same criteria that we've chosen for the experts on our site, which is, again, terminal degrees in Islamic law and American law, I think that we would welcome hearing their names.
For which I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say the incidents you've described seem to be oriented around a reaction to what people perceive Islam and Islamic law is. That it's this unitary concept. And what by presenting a much more diverse picture, rather than sort of inviting anyone to settle the question as to what it is or what it says. You're actually putting it on a footing that maybe is more familiar to us. And that's why I raised the example of Protestantism, is that no one expects there to be a single voice articulating what the Protestant view is on a given matter. And so maybe that's at a bare minimum something to overcome here.
May I add to that briefly? My understanding of the project is kind of twofold. On the one hand side, yes, it's adding nuance and complexity and richness and above all contextuality to these debates. But then on the other hand side, I think it also has a clarification function where much of the public debate and what we read in newspapers is just kind of in a straightforward way misinformed at a very basic level. It's like to say, well, we don't have privacy protection in the US, says the European. That's just simply wrong, right? There are, of course, privacy protections. So I think much of the examples you've used are at a level where you don't have to go into the level of deep interpretation. And, you know, scholars may disagree on nuances and refer to all sorts of interpretive sources of the past, but where actually there is rough consensus that this is simply wrong, right? So I think this addresses, has kind of this longer-term strategy of, okay, educating the public and journalists in particular about the richness and the diversity of viewpoints and so forth. But it has also this corrective function where things are just simply wrong. And as we all know, the U.S. media, as well as the European, usually don't tend to be very differentiated in their coverage of these topics, right? So I'm less concerned about the diversity
the
of viewpoints issues here.
Yeah, I was thinking along the same lines that educating the public is really actually one of the most probably generative things you can do, because you also want people who say, you know, I watched the news and they said that, I don't know, when a letter was written to President Bush and they said this is a rambling letter, I said, oh my God, nobody knows how Islamic letters are written. So there is something about Islamic culture and Islamic society that people don't know. So when you watch the news, you don't know how to tell whoever it was, Peter Jennings, what are you saying here, right? So as people from different perspectives watch the news, whether it's teachers or, you know, students or even children, it would be incredibly useful to have a site where people say, let's go there and find out, because they take our questions and they're answering these questions and gradually build up a sort of a database of all of this information where people can go and say, what's the difference between a church and a mosque? Right? I mean, that's a fundamental question, because you don't make a judgment without knowing where the phenomenon is coming from. And I think, you know, in some ways, because I'm an anthropologist, this whole idea of the familiar and the strange is a really important dialectic. And so if you say, oh, they build a mosque every time they go and conquer somewhere, right? I'm thinking, all right, Catholics, yep, they did that. So am I, you know, is it ethnocentrism? And so it's a way to help the public develop also the idea that there is a way in which we can find out something, and then this would be a site where it's written in a way that is scholarly for some people, but has a version that is really accessible to an eighth grader or a fifth grader.
Yeah, thank you for that. And that's actually a really important point. I spoke to a couple weeks ago over at the post 9/11 conference here at the law school, and this whole idea of othering of Islam, Muslims, Islamic law, as a sort of quick, lazy way to come to conclusions. So I traced a couple of court decisions where the Muslim plaintiff loses, and it's always very interesting to me reviewing cases, even when I teach American criminal law, how you construe the facts or how the judge, you know, talks about the facts after you know, the trial is all said and done, and it seems to flow very nicely. The facts say this, and the conclusion is this. And in the cases about religious discrimination that seem a little bit absurd and where Muslim plaintiff loses, it's chock full of Arabic terms all over the place, Sharia, jihad, hijab, where there are either English equivalents or ways that they could be described or explained in English, so why the foreign terms? So I think that's a very important point, and that is something we hope to incorporate in the site, something like just a database glossary of terms, commonly asked questions, and gradually build that up. So thank you.
And it's searchable, and that maybe links to other sources too. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, thank you.
So my question relates to sort of the operational strategy of Islamics as it relates to the idea of connecting newsreaders, media producers, and legal scholars. So how much of what you hope to do is sort of active versus passive? So for example, if I go on Wikipedia and I look up a sukuk or I look up other terms within Islamic law, I can get background information. I mean, here you're providing trending data, you're providing sort of opinion pieces by Islamic law scholars. But how much of that is just, how much of it is, are you just expecting people to come to the site? And how much of it will entail, I mean, sort of actively driving people to this site? Like, will Islamics have a staff? Will Islamics be in touch with media producers, news reporters, after certain events happen? Like, will this be sort of a 501c3? Like, what will this project actually look like? How much of it is active? How much of it is just sort of a passive information resource?
So I can speak to that a little bit. Just recently, for example, I attended a conference called Covering Islam in the Bible Belt, which brought together, I think, about 22 journalists from across the Bible Belt for whom their beat is Islam and Muslims. I've maintained relationships with those journalists, and now I, in fact, help them when they were developing stories, some of them. I've worked with them to develop, you know, interesting angles on those stories. Here are things you might want to cover, and, oh, here's a scholar who could help you cover that really well if you wanted to reach out to this particular expert amongst our panel of experts. So that is a very active process. We are also, in general, developing our database of journalists that we'll stay in touch with. So if you know people who you think would be interested, do send them our way. And then finally, on a sort of more passive sense, one of the things that we're trying to do is develop what we call backgrounders, and they are essentially sort of explanatory, really accessible interview-style documents that'll be on the site. So it'll be something like, you know, what's the deal with the headscarf? You know, is it mandated? Where does it come from? What did it mean historically? That sort of thing. So if you want to cover a story that has that involved in it, you would be able to look at the backgrounder, get a little bit up to speed, and then maybe even know that that is a particular scholar, the one who did the backgrounder, that you'd want to connect with when you ultimately did your story. So I think we're trying to do a mix of sort of both passive and active, and that's really just a bandwidth issue, is that we have, you know, our three co-founders and a lot of very interested volunteers and a lot of very active volunteers, but, you know, we do what we can with the staff we have.
One of that is the grayed out sections right now that you see on the nav bar. We'd like to do more targeted sort of backgrounders or contextual surveys of issues, in-depth analysis you see. Those would be more scholarly articles that are presented in digestible form, cases where we'll actually have a database of cases. All these things are in the works, and we have lots of information gathered for that, and we're trying to figure out how to best roll it out, and then legislation is another. And we're also very excited to be working with IRS and others at the Berkman Center, because they have a lot of expertise with just how do you connect more actively to media outlets and, you know, some of the more technical things that I don't know a lot about. What does it take to make this have high SEO on Google when people search Islamic law or Sharia or Muslim or Victory Mosque or what have you?
And just to add one more thing, I think that, you know, we played with the idea of doing a PolitiFact style, you know, feature on our site. But ultimately, I think while there's some value in looking at a story and saying, well, is this bad? How bad is it? You know, the real value is in helping develop good stories. And so to that extent, we're doing the best we can to work with journalists that we know and increase our database of journalists so that we can influence those stories by helping them see what we call the negative space and the issues that haven't yet been covered and say, hey, you know, here's an angle on, you know, the Arab Spring, say, for example, which dominated our news coverage for so many months. Here's an angle that you haven't thought of. You know, here's a way that I can help you get that story done.
Yes.
Who's in their Rolodex now?
Who's in their Rolodex now?
Who's in our Rolodex now?
No, the journalist's Rolodex. Who do they contact?
A journalist of the New York Times. Who do they just Google, or who do they contact?
You know, I think they get a couple of good contacts who are responsive to them, and I think that they use a lot of the same contacts over and over.
We've done a preliminary survey, and we're doing a larger project on just this question: who are the sources that are being used in existing stories on Islam, Islamic law, Muslims in America? And what we found is that there's a mix. Oftentimes, they're advocates for some view or another, whether Muslim advocates whose expertise is that they advocate for Muslim rights or something like that. But it's not that there's expertise or experience studying or working in areas of Islamic law. So examples of that are Muslim advocates or care organizations like this. And on the other side, you have the same thing. So there are what, you know, is being popularly called Islamophobes, people who have some axe to grind generally against Muslims and that sort of thing. So they'll be consulted, and you get those as the experts in a lot of these articles. Sometimes, occasionally, you have some of the very same scholars that we're working with, especially Muhammad Fadl here, or Enver Iman. But again, capacity and bandwidth issue, even with them, if they wanted to contact them, it can't be that these two scholars, just because they pick up the phone, are going to be able to pick up the phone for the 50 times that the journalists call them.
So thank you for this. I think that this resource is, we need more things like this, and this is really, really useful to the public and to the debate in general. I guess I would have a more basic question. My question would be, why or how did you choose that focus on Islamic law per se as compared to Islamic culture, for instance, or even Arabic culture, in which you would have also a lot to say? Islamic culture, I don't know if it maps totally with Islamic law. Arabic culture would comprise those great Christian minorities that you can find and who play a great role in Egypt, in Syria, or Iraq. So
My question would be more basic. Why Islamic law, and what does that encompass?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Ambreen spoke to it a little bit, and feel free to jump in as well. But I'll just say a couple of things. Why Islamic law is that we, in our survey, looking at some of the stories covering these issues, we often found that stories that seem to be about culture or theology or style ended up really being about competing interpretations of Islamic law in the background, especially since Islam, like Judaism, is a law-centered religion in that it expresses ritual and belief more in terms of praxis than theological belief and that sort of thing. So it ends up being articulated in terms of Islamic law, and then you have all of these competing interpretations about it. And so law seemed to be the unifying element across those issues and a way to cabin the focus to something that's manageable so that we're not saying we're giving you a theory of everything. And then on the flip side, Islamic culture, I don't know what that is, meaning that, you know, there are a billion Muslims in the world, 1.3, 1.5 billion, some estimates are, and that stretches from anywhere from America, North America, South America, to the largest grouping in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and Malaysia. And it's actually only 13% of the Muslim, so-called Muslim world, is Arab. And so by way of extension, that's also why not Arabic culture, why we chose not to focus on that. But the issues, in addition to there sort of not being a coherence of culture as it applies to diverse groupings of Muslims, the issues seem to be about competing interpretations of Islamic law. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think you covered it well. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, the point of departure that you mentioned for the website is that journalists act in good faith, which I think is the right approach. However, it seems to me that the most common and recent misconceptions about Islamic law and Islam in general, such as the Islamic Center, concerning the Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan, were not driven at all by journalistic good faith, but rather by a political agenda and people with an axe to grind, as you just pointed out, against Islam. Now, how do you cope with that? And are you intending to push back against journalism in bad faith?
Okay, see you, Ambreen.
You're gonna send a hard question my way, huh?
Why not?
So, you know, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, part of this is that I don't think it's productive to start a project by assuming that the people that we're working with are operating in bad faith, which is why we are assuming, of course, that they're operating in good faith. And in reality, that's been my experience by talking to journalists who cover these stories, that they are looking for quotes, they are looking for sources, they are having trouble finding them. To the extent that these issues are driven by politics and so on, you know, the more you help journalists cover these stories better, I think that that's a small way of tackling the political issues. I mean, how do you get to Newt Gingrich and say, stop saying things that are just factually incorrect? I don't know. I mean, that's something that I would really welcome all of your thoughts on. But I do think what is important for us is to note that most people's interface with Islam and Muslims in this country is through the news. I mean, there aren't that many Muslims in this country that everybody can have a Muslim friend or have a regular interaction with someone who's Muslim. So the vast majority of information that people learn about Islam and Muslims comes through what they see on the news. Therefore, that seemed to be the biggest sort of like pressure point for us to be able to tackle.
You know, so this site or what we want to do here is in the way of presenting or connecting the information to everyone, to the average newsreader, which may include Muslims. So even if you know a Muslim, there's a Muslim in the community, that's not to say that they either know about these issues that come up within Islamic law. So, I mean, there can be issues that need to be clarified within the Muslim community, without, but But we do think that a lot of the majority interface ends up being through the media when learning about these issues in the broader community. Yes.
I was wondering with regard to the benefit you see coming from this project, there would appear to be a range of misinformation out there, and you'll have people who are mildly misinformed about one or two discrete issues all the way to the really committed ideologues. And you see the benefit coming from those on the margin who are mildly misinformed, correcting those minor issues, or do you hope even have an impact with the most committed ideologues, if not necessarily winning them over, having some marginal reduction in the intensity of the misinformation they're spreading?
I think that, that's an interesting question. I have a selfish stake in it, in that I love sites like SCOTUS blog and Prof's blog, where academics can really sort of get down and dirty and discuss amongst themselves, what about gambling in Islamic law? Or what does Islamic law have to say about the death of Troy Davis, or that sort of thing? And those are the sort of issues I'd like to discuss amongst a combination of folks that have background in it and that have background in American law and are curious about these issues. And so that's one aspect of the site. Legal scholars, who I don't think are ideologues or typically aren't when they approach these issues in any measure, but that might be interested in having these debates. And so for me, that's exciting to be able to have a space to do that. But then in this media space that we've been talking about more so, I think that it's a more generalist, the area for which we hope to have the largest impact would be a more generalist one. I personally don't think that minds will change if you're coming to the table with the determination that your mind not be changed or enlightened and that sort of thing. But for people that just, are looking for information or have no knowledge and want to inform themselves, I think that's where the biggest impact will be.
And Urs touched on this a little bit earlier, but I think, the reality is that there are facts that relate to some of these things. I mean, there are answers to some of these questions, and it's really difficult from time to time to get them. And, between the three of us that are co-founders of this project, the only expert on Islamic law is Intisar. So we call her all the time and say, what does Islamic law say about X, Y, or Z? And for me, who is, into this idea, has studied this for a long time, thinks about it, I even find it difficult to find out what Islamic law says about X, Y, or Z. I just think it's hard. I think that there are no resources, no authoritative sources out there, and I think a Google search doesn't get me to where I want to go. So our hope is that for people who are open-minded, that they will be able to come to a site and say, well, what does Islamic law say about, we keep saying the death penalty today for some reason, but what does it say about the death penalty? And you are able then to see, 13 different scholars who may have 13 different opinions. I don't know, but you can see what the diversity of opinion on the death penalty has been historically, and you'll be able to see what Islamic law has said over this course of time about something. So I think the problem that we're dealing with really is that there's a void, and it's being filled, and it's not being filled by authoritative voices.
So it's really interesting because this is my first time hearing about this. But I just have this question because I live in an Islamic country, and I see if one want to talk about Islamic law, they have authority, like legislative branch talks about the issue about the country, the culture there, and a lot of values, and use the resources and reuse the sources in Islamic law and interpret it and use the laws in the country. But what I understand here is like those people will be the legislative branch for Islamic law here, to talk about the issue in American law, saying, okay, this is what we think in Islamic perspective, but this is what about fatwa, for instance. So do you think this is like that, or just we give information about Islamic law from this perspective, for instance, Egypt, they have madhab, doctrine of Hanafi, they use this in family law, or in Saudi Arabia they use this in family law. So it would be really a bit confused for the people who don't know anything about Islamic law, but what I see would be like, it's like a suggestion that if these people like would focus on more about like Islam, like American society, what about like how to interpret Islamic law in American society, how to use like laws in Islamic law, like, and tell people this is what about if you are in Islamic society, because it would be like more about like fatwas, and also they can like talk about people who are having a religious perspective, because this is a religion more about being a law. So this is what I just said. So.
Thank you. If I understand your question and comment correctly, I think you're pointing to a very important difference between foreign laws and state laws and Islamic law as state law, and this broader, more amorphous field of Islamic law where it's not connected to any particular country, as in Saudi Arabia or Egypt. And so what are we doing here? Are we saying this is what the laws are in a particular country? Or are we giving advisory opinions about how to practice Islamic law and that sort of thing? But I think the latter thing that you said is more along the lines of what we're doing, is providing information about how particular issues that keep coming up in the American context. So again, we're focusing on American news media and reporting about Islamic law here, even though that may sometimes go to issues of Islamic law abroad, particularly with the new reporting on the Arab Spring and that sort of thing. But what we'd like to do is to just provide information or add some context to these issues. This is the background, here's what it means, here are some implications, and then perhaps draw on Islamic law as state law in other countries as illustrative examples for how these things may play out elsewhere, or what the range of meanings were in historic times, which is still relevant to modern times, because everyone who appeals to Islamic law today appeals to this classical ideal version of Islamic law. They always want to go back to, well, in the beginning, sort of like we do with the founding fathers, we want to talk about original intent and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Same within Islamic law. If we can point to, this was the practice in the first three centuries amongst the sort of lights that modern folks, whether it's in an academic context or a religious context, point to as sources of law, even, or exponents of law, then I think that would be a value that I'd see in the site, is just more information rather than advisory opinions or anything like that. Anything else? We probably have time for one more question. Yes?
Are you getting the uptake you wanted? Does your phone ring often enough?
Is the phone ringing, Umbreen?
My phone doesn't ring all that much, but that might be because I hate the phone, but my email inbox gets a lot. So there is that. We haven't done our sort of big formal launch. So right now we have relationships with people that we've been very careful to develop relationships with. We haven't sort of done a big blast yet. And my hope is that once we do, that we will be reaching a lot more people, and a lot more people will be reaching out to us.
Data, we're hoping to launch soon in conjunction with a strategy that Berkman is helping to outline for the project. And we've already had some bites, and we hope that, we'll get more after the fact. But for all of you, I do want to just, again, thank you for coming and invite you to please sign up on the site for the email list, and also email one of us or info or editor@islamics.com, which is right on the homepage under Contact Us. And feel free to send any suggestions, objections that you might not have wanted to raise here, or comments to us on the site. And we'd love the feedback. We'd love to try to use that to build a better site. Thank you.